Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In 1968, The New Yorker hired Ellen Willis as its first popular music critic. She had a column titled Rock, Etc., and it ran for 7 years and established her as a leader in cultural commentary and a pioneer in the male-dominated field of rock criticism. She went on to do other things after being there for a long period of time. She was an editor and columnist at the Village Voice. She wrote for Rolling Stone, The New York Times, The Nation, and Dissent. She was the founder of the Cultural Reporting and Criticism Program at New York University. And she published 3 books of essays, Beginning to See the Light, No More Nice Girls, and Don't Think, Smile. She has a daughter, and the apple has not fallen far from the tree in this case. Nona Willis Aronowitz has put together her mother's columns along with commentary. The book is Out of the Vinyl Deeps, Ellen Willis on Rock Music. And indeed, she does establish that her mother was a big deal. The columns are just really engaging. I am amazed that she has fallen from public view for a long period of time, because the way she writes about Bob Dylan, you would think would be studied and read by many, many years later. She says that a lot of people acknowledged her mother's contributions. Her mother was named The New Yorker's first pop music critic when she was 26 and was one of the only women to elbow through the exclusive testosterone-fueled rock criticism scene. She handed me, while she was doing a writing about her column, she handed her column on Woodstock. And there are so many columns that look with great honesty and exquisite writing. Woodstock and Stevie Wonder and Bob Dylan and Joni Mitchell and the Velvet Underground and all the performers who really had political statements, many of them, and some were just good to dance to. Nona Willis Aronowitz is with us this hour, and we're so happy she has put together this book. We're going to hear some of the music, too, that her mother writes about. Nona, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and you are such an accomplished writer yourself. Your mother would be so proud of you. You've written for The Nation, The New York Observer, The Village Voice, and Salon. You're author of Girl Drive, Crisscrossing America, Redefining Feminism. Indeed, the apple did not fall too far from the tree, did it?
No, I mean, it was always really natural for me to express myself through writing. And actually, I had Mom as my first and still best editor the first few years that I was writing.
You know, what bothers me is I read all of this and I am bothered and delighted at the same time. I'm so glad you published these because they are so beautiful. Her writing is just exquisite, and her thought pattern, she's described as somebody who never said anything if she hadn't thought it through, and you can tell from her writing that there's so much depth to what she has to say.
Yeah, I mean, don't be too disturbed, because I think that this collection was not put out during her lifetime for a reason. I think she had moved on from rock criticism before some of her colleagues, and they sort of honed in on this one slice of culture, and she was really more interested in the bigger picture. And it's kind of hard to pin her down because of that, because she wrote about politics, she wrote about, you know, feminism, she wrote about foreign policy, she wrote all over the map. So, she wasn't super interested in putting together this volume.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, still, when she died, I kind of had to follow the lead of all the people who were reaching out to me, telling me that some of her most affecting work were these columns.
I love the way you started the book. If you could please take us back to December. It was you were 12 years old and you had to get a Christmas present or a holiday present or birthday present, it was, for your mom. It's a great story.
Yeah. I had always known that she was a writer and she wrote about culture, but basically what I had noticed the most is that she loved rock and roll. And so I went to Tower Records and I spied the Janis Joplin box set. And I was like, this is perfect. I've always heard Janis in my house. Like, they even have the same, you know, big poofy hair. This is going to be great. So, you know, I took out my allowance money, wrapped it up, and was really excited to give it to her. And when I did, she dropped the bomb that not only did she have the collection, but she had also written the liner notes for them. And I just felt so defeated at that moment, but it really occurred to me that she was a big deal.
She was a big deal. And she gave you, you gave her the present that would forever make her happy, even though she's no longer with us, and that's the work that you do. I mean, what a tribute to who she was and what she did. Let's start with Bob Dylan here, because Bob Dylan just fascinates me. I once had a dream many years ago, and I'll never forget this dream. I was sitting in a cloud with Bob Dylan. It was one of those fluffy white clouds. And we sang together every single song that he had ever written. I don't know the lyrics to all the Bob Dylan songs, but somehow they were omnipresent. And I knew all of them in this dream. I've never forgotten that dream. It was just wonderful. But I find him endlessly fascinating and endlessly important for such a long period of time now. As your mother wrote, people thought he might commit suicide. He might become a druggie. He might, who knows what would happen. And look at how long he has survived. She paid very, very careful attention to him.
Yes, she did. I mean, she always had kind of an ongoing dialogue with him. I mean, they were the same age. She had followed him from folk to rock and through all of his phases. And she was really very hard on him, even though she was fascinated by him. I think more than anybody, she did think that he sort of spoke to this countercultural generation, but that not everybody who felt the message actually understood it. So this first big essay that she had, just simply titled Dylan, it was very long. It's the first essay in the book. She really breaks down what this bohemian moment meant to people. And I think people really responded to that because a lot of people were sort of feeling Bob Dylan without really thinking about him. And so she's very hard on him at the same time. She, you know, she just deconstructs him. But she also really admired him.
Mm-hmm. He is a, and I'm wondering how you would compare his being widely read to some of the other people your mother writes about. She mentions the fact that he was widely read, and he certainly, from references to classics and to writers in his songs, you have to be somewhat a sophisticated reader to understand the depth of what he writes and sings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think, I mean, she was a little bit less, I mean, on one hand, yes, you had to be well-read to delve into the meaning of his lyrics. But on the other hand, he really just embodied a sort of anti-establishment feeling that a lot of people from different classes and socioeconomic backgrounds could relate to. And I think that she loved his lyrics, but she also loved his persona, and she loved the fact that he was sort of playing with people's expectations.
Your mom must have really valued a great knowledge base as well. She, I imagine, was extremely well-read.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my dad always says that my mom was one of the only people he'll actually call brilliant. she was definitely a bookworm. An incredibly observant. She actually wasn't a gregarious, outgoing person. So, you know, most of the time she was taking everything in and really being, you know, having a discerning eye in the world. So she always worked very hard in school and, you know, she always had, you know, writing skills. But she also was an incredibly observant, inward person.
Mm-hmm. How did she get the job? We're going to play a little bit of Dylan, and I know, as you just said, the book starts with this beautiful essay on Dylan. It was the strength of that particular piece that got her this coveted job?
Yeah, I mean, the way she described it somewhat humbly to me is that it was this exact right moment where all the big shot editors were realizing that there was something called youth culture out there and that they should probably have somebody to be writing about it. And they saw that one essay and were like, yes, her, she'd be good. She's 26. She understands what's going on. So she just waltzed into the New Yorker with jeans at the time, you know, at a time when women did not wear jeans at the New Yorker. And she just, you know, did what she pleased. She kind of had a really cushy gig, but I think it was a combination of her her incredible skill and also the incredible amount of ferment in journalism that was happening.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about more Dylan. We have a little bit more about Dylan, and also we'll talk about other people she wrote about. The beauty of this song we're about to hear, she says in part of the song in this essay about Dylan, Hard Rain, was that it exploited poetry while remaining a folk lyric, simple, repetitive, seemingly uncontrived. She also has criticism for Dylan becoming a self-consciously poetic guy. But in the beauty of this, it's poetic and uncontrived. We'll hear a little bit of Dylan. Hard Rain's Gonna Fall.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? And where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of 12 dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rain that's gonna fall.
Bob Dylan and Now Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. Your mother also writes, and I think this is true of Dylan, although it becomes sometimes really hard to understand what he's saying. I hate to have to work when I'm listening to a song, but that he expresses an incredible amount of emotion, probably more than anybody else in his voice.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it never really bothered her that he wasn't a good singer, and she was actually never interested in technicalities of music that some other critics were. She actually has a sentence in the book that says something like, you know, paying attention to the little minutiae in music is kind of boring. Like, why don't you understand where it is culturally? That's what's interesting. And I think, you know, something about Dylan's persona and voice really spoke to her.
She calls him, and I want you to take this from your generation as well, a visionary, which I think is an accurate description of him. Are there visionaries now that you find through, as you examine popular culture now?
You know, it's really not the same kind of collective experience. Mm. I mean, I don't know whether we're just not in the same kind of musical moment or cultural moment, or whether it's the way we get our music. It's probably a combination of the two. But there's really not this kind of generational experience, at least in my opinion. Like the last time I really felt that was like when Kurt Cobain died, and everybody was really affected by it, and this kind of wave of alternative music, which like also came with not only Riot Girl, but sort of the women in rock meme of the early to mid 90s. That was the last time I sort of saw a moment in music, frankly. And even though I'm such a huge fan of hip hop, and I know that maybe hip hop fans are saying, hello, hip hop, I still don't find that there was like a big generational cultural moment with hip hop after about the mid 90s. And like I said, it might just be because radio stations aren't as important in our lives. Like we don't experience music in a collective way, and it might also be because we just don't happen to be connecting culture with a huge political moment right now. I mean, you know, elections and things like that are always connected to pop culture in some way. Like, you know, the Will I Am video, for instance. Some people would argue that it helped Obama get elected, and I'm not. Denying those particular cultural moments, but I don't see a total analogy.
And your mom,
sad to say that, but
your mom thought that her cultural moment had passed in the 1980s too, right? When she stopped writing rock criticism.
Well, I wouldn't say her cultural moment, that she felt her cultural moment had passed, but she really thought that music and rock music particularly had been divorced from counterculture and this kind of revolutionary impulse. I mean, it was always commercialized, but I mean, she definitely makes that clear from the beginning that it always kind of had a commercial impulse, but it really did not signify a forward-thinking ethos anymore for her.
Mm-hmm.
So I think she always paid attention to culture. She was always very tapped into the cultural conversation, as she called it, but not necessarily in this micro way with rock music. Because after all, she never thought of it as a micro conversation, and she felt like it became that way.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls, too, for our guest, the daughter of Ella Willis, Nona Willis Aronowitz, who has put together a really interesting compilation of her mom's columns for The New Yorker over a seven-year period of time. And trust me, they're really very, very good. For those of us who grew up in that era, you'll find these really very much to the point, and just as she was, columns that make you think and also make you want to dance, because there's a picture of her in the book where she's standing next to a mirror and she's dancing to, I don't know if it's Creedence Clue. Let's play a little dancey bit before we have to pause. What did she like to dance to, just to have pure fun with?
Well, there's this sort of famous, one of my favorites at least, paragraphs in the book about her dancing to Creedence when she was feeling particularly down, and she just danced to record after record after record, and after she was done and after she had exhausted herself, she actually felt better.
I'm with her on that. Let's hear a little of Creedence Clearwater Revival. Janis Joplin and Get It While You Can. Our guest this hour is Nona Willis Aronowitz. She has put together, and we're happy she did so, a collection of her mother's columns, Ellen Willis's columns for The New Yorker. Out of the Vinyl Deeps is the name of it. Nona herself is quite an accomplished writer, written about women, sex, music, technology, film, and youth culture for The Nation, The New York Observer, The Village Voice, The Chicago Tribune. She has produced for WNYC's music talk show, Soundcheck, and a nationally broadcast radio series on the midterm elections called Pop and Politics, and she's the author of Girl Drive, Crisscrossing America, Redefining Feminism. And let's talk a little bit about women in this business. She writes, we just heard Janis Joplin, that she belongs to a select group of pop figures who mattered as much for themselves as for their music. What did she mean by that?
Well, I think she was very affected by what Janice, the appearance of her, her theatricality, what that meant for women, just as much as she was, enhanced or loved her music. I think, you know, Janice's appearance was very unconventional. She had crazy wild hair. She wasn't super stick thin. She never wore much makeup. And I think Mom saw this sex symbol, basically, and was like, wow, you don't have to stuff yourself in a girdle and put red lipstick on to be attractive and to be incredibly sensual. And she said when she saw Janice that she decided that then and there that that was the moment she was not going to straighten her hair.
Really?
Yeah. So I feel like, you know, seeing Janice and also seeing her demise and seeing how culture reacted and how the American public reacted to her death and her addiction really deeply affected her, and she sort of saw a lot of proto-feminism in Janice.
Mm-hmm.
So I think besides her music, besides loving the way she sang things, because after all, she didn't, you know, write most of her music, she also thought her persona was incredibly important for the nascent feminist movement.
Let's go to a couple callers, or at least one, Solia in Viroqua. Hi, Solia.
Hi, thank you. I didn't catch, if you mentioned it, I didn't catch when it was that the guest's mother died. But at the time, I have two questions. One is, at the time she died, what did she think had become the role of music? I get the feeling that she may have said that it had deteriorated to some extent, or maybe not. And the other question is, maybe the guest would have some opinion about where she thinks the role of music in our culture needs to go or will go.
All right. Good thoughts and questions.
Well, she died in 2006, so relatively recently. I was 22 years old. And she hadn't really written about music since the early 80s. And I wouldn't say that she thought the position of music had deteriorated in society, but the sort of principles and the politics that she held very dear, you know, liberation politics, utopian politics, incredibly high hopes for the future in this very revolutionary way, she didn't see that being embodied in music after punk, I guess. And like I said, you know, she once in a while commented on certain individuals. She wrote things about Madonna. She wrote things about Alanis Morissette, Courtney Love, certain people like that. And of course, I would always have wanted to hear her perspectives on things like hip hop and Riot Girl. And she was very, very proud of the generation that came after her and encouraged them. She just wasn't super interested in it. And I think if she was alive today, she would push music critics to get out of their sort of esoteric music nerd speak and try to figure out what this music means for, you know, larger issues and, like, what's going on in society right now. I think she was a little bit disappointed that music sort of veered off. And it always, I guess, music criticism, rock criticism, always had that sect of just, like, zeroing in on this one aspect of culture and not connecting it to the rest of the world.
Mm. And you were a big hip-hop fan. She must have heard some of your music, and she sounded like she was the kind of mother who would treat you with a great deal of respect and respect your interests. Did you have long conversations about this? Did you have spirited debates about whose music, whose era was best?
No. I mean, first, I guess it was a combination of my mom's personality. She was incredibly demure as a person. Like, she would never challenge me in that confrontational way. It was she liked to let me figure things out for myself. Of course, I asked her questions about her work when I became old enough to understand her work. I read her books before she died, things like that. And sometimes she asked about my music. She liked my music. I mean, I remember putting on, like, hardcore hip hop, like Tupac and like DMX and Biggie and Wu-Tang, and her not really caring. And then, you know, she'd ask me about my favorites. I think we did have a couple of conversations about Tupac, because I think she knew that certain artists that I listened to, you know, were incredibly culturally significant, and especially for our generation, and especially in the 1990s. And so she definitely asked me. She was curious, but we never really had debates about it. I think she really wanted me to be, you know, not influenced by her until I'd already formed my own opinions.
She tracked every movement, you write, of The Who, Bob Dylan, The Stones, Janis, and the Velvet Underground, as she blatantly ignored others. Let's talk about the Velvet Underground. Why did she love them?
Well, she first of all thought that the Velvet Underground was before their time, and not only before their time, like ahead of their time, rather, not only ahead of their time, but also the first important band who didn't have mass appeal. So they were sort of this like incredibly resonant and influential band without being, you know, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Elvis, like all these people who had huge, overblown public personas. The Velvet Underground, she found an incredible amount of insight into just like personal addiction, personal liberation. She felt incredibly affected by Lou Reed's incredibly ambivalent narrative about drugs and pleasure, and she picked it as her favorite or an album that she would bring to a desert island like the Velvet Underground Best Of, because she saw so much complexity in it, and it like she said, it didn't, you know, that band, even though it's a classic band, it didn't blow up in the same way that most of these people did. But she still thought it was incredibly influential, and she's right. She thought it was the beginning of punk.
Sometimes I feel so happy. Sometimes I feel so sad. Sometimes I feel so happy. But mostly you just make me mad. Baby, you just make me mad. Linger on. Your pale blue eyes. Linger on. Your pale
Velvet Underground and Pale Blue Eyes. This hour of the program, we're talking about Out of the Vinyl Deeps, Ellen Willis on Rock Music, a book filled with her mother's really insightful, wonderful essays on rock music of the 1960s and 70s, put together by her daughter, Nona Willis Aronowitz. Nona herself is a very accomplished writer. She's written for The Nation, The New York Observer, The Village Voice, Salon, and is a co-author of Girl Drive, Crisscrossing America, Redefining Feminism. We're welcoming phone calls if you'd like to join our conversation. It may be one of those that's hard to pinpoint what you want to say, but many of you know exactly what you want to say, so feel free to call in anytime you'd like. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Your mother's writing has been criticized. Tell me if you think it's justified, the bulk of it, for not paying enough attention to soul music that came out of this era. What do you think?
I mean, I totally agree. I think she was very sort of like white people-centric when it came to music. I mean, she had obviously, especially like black women, she didn't really mention in her book. I mean, she holds up Janis as like the emblem of female empowerment without even mentioning Aretha Franklin. I think maybe she had like one sentence about Aretha Franklin, but she was very honest about what world she lived in, and she lived in a really segregated world. I mean, like the New York counterculture of the 60s and 70s in Greenwich Village was pretty white. And she definitely loved certain people like Otis Redding, Sam Cooke, et cetera, but she rarely ever sort of delved into that world. And I think that that definitely hinders the book. But like I think somebody says in the book, you know, she never wrote about anything she hadn't thought through, and she never really spouted off opinions about things she didn't know about. So that's possibly why she turned a blind eye to that entire section of 60s and 70s music. That said, she does have pretty amazing essays. Well, she has a great essay on Otis Redding, and she has a couple of essays on soul music.
On Stevie Wonder, too, certainly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, right, and Stevie Wonder, exactly. So it's not like she was totally
right
blind to that era, but she did sort of neglect that part of
She also just missed, those of us of a certain age have more than one Aretha Franklin CDs in the kitchen to dance to.
Yeah, I mean, she loved Aretha Franklin, but she was clearly not deeply affected by her for one reason or another.
Yeah. Let's go to another caller, Mark in Door County. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if your mother was ever made comments about how the Eastern religions during the 80s about how late 70s, 80s, all the interests in Buddhism and Eastern religious traditions.
Well, I think that she did touch on that earlier when George Harrison, went to India and brought that back, and she was incredibly secular as a person, even though she was raised kind of semi-secular Jewish. But I don't think she was interested in like religious, I guess, like Eastern influences.
Meditation or things
culture.
Like that?
I think that she was very, you know, America-centric. Like she was trying to figure out this country, you know. Does that answer your question?
Sure. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. We can't talk about what we're talking about for an hour without hearing the Beatles, and I know that she thought this was a very beautiful song, and I'm interested in what she had to say about the Beatles, which we'll discover in a moment.
Here comes the sun, and I say it's all right.
The Beatles, and Here Comes the Sun. And your mother thought, I think she described this as one of the more joyful songs she had ever heard. It really is, isn't it? It just, we should all play it every day when we wake up and head out the door. Don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, she really loved John Lennon, too. She always was on Team John, I'd say.
Why?
I think that she thought he understood the counterculture a little bit better, and he had a little bit more political insight than the rest of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was very self-righteous, and I know that she kind of got frustrated at this weird sort of facile optimism that she perceived the Beatles had, but I think she thought he was a little bit more serious about revolution than the rest of them.
Mm-hmm. And she appreciated the musical composition of what they did. They really did some lovely arrangements of songs.
Sure, yeah. I mean, the Beatles were never on her top five list, and she actually didn't write about them as much as you might expect. But of course, she could always get down with with a Beatles song and a Beatles album. That said, she critiqued some of the greats. I mean, there's a long piece about the White Album that's just sort of a lukewarm review. She didn't buy into what everybody else was thinking about an incredibly beloved group.
I think she said she loved Abbey Road and Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, Sgt. Pepper's album as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was more her style, like a tighter album that sort of had a continuity through it that really reflected the culture in which she was living.
So when you mentioned, I was reading, and I can't find it in my notes, her top 10 albums from 1974. So until I find that, the top five on her list would be always?
Let's see. Bob Dylan, Janis Joplin. Of course, we've already talked about them. I'd say the Rolling Stones and Velvet Underground and Creedence, probably. Hmm. Although Creedence, I mean, I don't remember Creedence being played in my house. All that much. I mean, I remember all those other four. And then I think maybe Creedence wasn't as much, didn't hold up as much throughout the years for her personally. Like, I'm not sure she ever, like, put on Creedence to hang out in the 90s. But I still think that that she really connected with them. So I'd put them on the top five.
All right, let's hear some Rolling Stones. We haven't talked about them yet, and then we'll talk about them.
Okay.
The Rolling Stones, in an article she wrote in December of 1973, there was a time when a new Rolling Stones album was an automatic instant rush fueled by Mick Jagger's phenomenal power to create and control his universe, a power as exciting as it was at times offensive. But then the Stones began to sing about their own nervous breakdowns instead of other people's. The hysteria of Gimme Shelter and the resignation of You Can't Always Get What You Want converged in the impotent horror of Altamont. It gives you an idea of the depth of her writing, because she's on a lot of different levels. She's not just listening to music, which she appreciates, but she's has a keen eye in observing Mick Jagger and who he is and who's on his arm.
Right. Well, she didn't give anybody a free ride. I mean, you know, that saying, you know, you're hardest on the ones you love, that was definitely true in this case. But she defended the Rolling Stones to the death as a very, very important and sort of even utopian rock band, even when her feminist friends were decrying Mick Jagger's misogyny. She always told them, she said, you know, yes, he's misogynist, but you can always channel his rage against the establishment and his playfulness and his, you know, need for a cultural revolution, you can channel that into your feminism, and you can kind of co-opt that into your feminism.
That is a complicated thought. did she like to go to concerts? Did she hear them in concert frequently and the other groups she writes about?
Yeah, I mean, she definitely talks about her experience listening to the music and experiencing the music in concert with other people, in addition to her spinning it on her own record player, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think she was kind of obliged to go to concerts as a critic. And from what I know about my mom, she didn't love huge parties. She wasn't the life of the party. So maybe, I mean, I have no idea if she would go to a lot of concerts if she wasn't a critic. But she definitely paid attention to how other people were reacting to the music.
Just what you said, spinning the records, a great majority of the people alive today have never done that.
You know, vinyl is making a comeback.
Is it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not with kids, I don't think, but with people my age, I think people feel an impulse to go back to something tangible. And, you know, CDs don't hold up very well. Tapes, of course, don't hold up very well. And MP3s, you're always afraid you're going to lose them on the computer, or they don't sound as good. So I know a lot of people my age are sort of going back to records.
Huh.
It sounds different. It really does. Actually, I have a huge collection, some of which are hers, but my husband and I are always buying new records because now they come with an MP3, so it's not dead yet.
All right. Well, that's good to hear. Let me give our number again. Feel free to join our conversation anywhere along the way. 800-486-8655 is our number. Rick in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. And it's a great conversation as someone who loves music. So, and you were talking before just a little bit about John Lennon, who's one of my favorites, and I wondered what your mother might have wrote, if anything, or said about his death. And I'll take the answer off the air. Mm. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
She never wrote a piece about John Lennon the way she wrote a piece about Bowie or the way she wrote a piece about Lou Reed. She never really got into his psychology. But every time she reviewed an album, she always made sure to say, you know, John, at least the songs that John were writing, seemed to be a lot more politically astute and seemed to be a lot more plugged into what was going on around them. So I would have loved to see a profile piece of John, the way she sort of dissected some of these other artists.
Hmm.
But she doesn't have one.
Yeah. Well, maybe you could write it. Well, you could.
Maybe.
Yeah. We're welcoming phone calls. Our guest has put together a compilation of her mother's wonderful criticisms, rock criticisms. She was her mother, Ellen Willis, the first popular music critic for The New Yorker, hired when she was 26 years old, and on the basis of one piece that she had written for another magazine, a wonderful piece on Dylan. The book, Out of the Vinyl Deeps, collects her rock, etc. columns, and her daughter is also quite a writer herself. Nona Willis Aronowitz has written about women, sex, music, technology, film, and youth culture for The Nation, The New York Observer, The Village Voice, Chicago Tribune, and Salon. She produces music talk shows, and she's author of Girl Drive, Crisscrossing America, Redefining Feminism. She lives in New York City. Coming up, we will... Joni Mitchell. Let's do Joni Mitchell. Coming up, we'll do her and also Bruce Springsteen. So we have to move along. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you're driving into town with a dark cloud above you, dial in the number who's bound to love you. Oh, honey, you turn me on. I'm a radio. I'm a country station. I'm a little bit corny. I'm a wildwood flower. Waving for you, broadcasting tower, waving for you. And I'm sending out this signal here. I hope you can pick it up loud and clear. I know you don't like weak women, you get bored so quick. And you don't like strong women, cause they're hip to your tricks. It's been dirty for dirty down the line, but you know, I come when you whistle, when you're loving and kind.
Joni Mitchell, For the Roses album, 1972. Oh my, you turn me on, I'm a radio. I haven't listened to her in a long time. I need to listen to her again. Your mom writes in a column in March of 1973 that her fourth album, Blue, converted your mother from a well-wisher to a fan. She'd always liked her, but they had never really connected.
Yep. Those are the kind of, sentences laid bare that you find in this a lot. She doesn't mince words.
No, she doesn't.
I think that up until then she hadn't completely connected with the folk world in general. I think that's sort of a metaphor of how she felt about the folk world. Like, you know, good luck with your stuff. Like, I think you're doing a great job, but it never really cut her to her soul. And then she really thought blue was a lot more complicated, that Joni Mitchell was really exploring some of her own emotions and not just being like a songstress for this peaceful movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to a phone call. Sean in La Crosse. Hi, Sean.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, in your promo, you mentioned Patti Smith, and I wanted to hear a little bit more about her. She's always impressed me as being a poet and musician and still out there knocking them dead today. So I'll just listen off the air.
Thanks, Sean.
You know what? I always wondered why my mother didn't write more about Patti Smith. But what I do, what she has written is that she was a little wary of her one of the guys persona. I think, and this is something that I still hear in feminist circles today, that there's a thin line between, you know, taking on both masculine and feminine qualities and making it your own and just being your own person and saying screw the world, and then separating yourself from women by saying, oh no, like, you know, I'm not with you guys, I'm different, I'm one of the guys, and sort of there's this weird sucking up to guys, you know, when that happens, that isn't the most useful. I don't necessarily agree. I think that maybe Patti Smith was feeling that, and I don't necessarily think that women interpreted it like that. Just from what I've heard from so many women who are inspired by her androgynous devil-may-care persona, but I think that was my mother's first reaction to Patti Smith.
Mm-hmm. We have an email from Lynn in Milton. Did your mother ever write about Bruce Springsteen? Indeed, she did. Let's hear him, and we'll talk about what she has to say, which is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
In Sunnyside, good night. It's all right, Jane. I'll let the black boys in to light the soul flame. We may find it out on the street tonight, baby. Oh, we may walk till the morning light, maybe. Well, like a cool Romeo, we made his move. Oh, she looks so fine. And like a late Juliet, she knew it'd never be
Bruce true. Springsteen, an incident on 57th Street. I love what your mother writes about him. Springsteen looks and sounds uncannily like a younger, non-mellowed-out Dylan, and he has deliberately cultivated the resemblance. This is a nervy thing to do, since it not only tempts people to dismiss him as an imitator, but invites comparisons that almost have to be unfavorable, yet he always gets away with it.
Yeah. I think Mom really saw Bruce Springsteen as a bridge between, 1960s youth culture, which is really personified in Dylan, and this romanticization of lower middle class and working class sensibility. I think that this anti-elitism that nevertheless came from middle class and upper middle class kids didn't necessarily feel authentic, and Bruce Springsteen married the two. You know, he was equally rooted in people like Bob Dylan as he was in his very deliberately working class persona. So I think that's why she thought he added a little bit of something different.
Yeah.
He wasn't really trying to do the same thing as Bob Dylan. He wasn't quite as ironic, but he still had that kind of ironic flair to him.
The line she remembers, she thinks of Dylan with plenty of prophetic lines, but when she watches Bruce Springsteen, it's, nobody's ever taught you how to live out on the street, and now you're going to have to get used to it. Yeah, it's quite a line.
Yeah.
Oh, darn. Well, we're almost out of time. So we're going to have to say goodbye. I am so glad you put this together. It's just, it's a lost treasure, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, that. I think the silver lining of putting together work when somebody has already passed away is that people sometimes pay attention to it even more. And that's like a really morbid thing to say, but sometimes you only know what you have till you've lost it.
Mm-hmm.
And the same way I feel about Patti Smith and people's interpretation of her, like mom might not have put together this because she thought she didn't think it was all that important, but a lot of other people do. And I think she would have liked to see their reactions to the book.
Oh, she would have been so happy that you put it together, too. That was a hard loss for you, I'm sure. Thank you so much for being with us, and thanks for putting the book in our hands. Thanks, Nona.
Thank you so much.
Nona Willis Aronowitz. The book is Out of the Vinyl Deeps, Ellen Willis on Rock Music. It has just been published, and it is available in paperback. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this program, and to Rhonda Fanning for doing some on-air production, and Chrissy doing on-air production. And we got a lot going on here this hour. Thanks for all of your calls. Let's go listen to music. I'm going to do that today. I got to dig up some of these old albums. I'll be off tomorrow and Monday, Labor Day, taking in the final swimming experience of the summer. So until Tuesday, thanks very much for listening. As always, thanks for your calls.